The problem isn't gold's volatility, it's the volatility of irredeemable credit. All right, welcome everybody. This is David Morgan, and this is a conversation with Keith Weiner, CEO of Monetary Metals. We've had a relationship for quite some time. Keith came on the gold scene some time ago, and I remember it's been just a couple months, and gave him a phone call, and I couldn't get off. I think we talked for well over an hour, and it seemed like it'd been 5 minutes. We had so much in common, and you know what your long-range goals were and what you proceeded. Keith, I'm going to kind of start us, and this is not an interview. This is just a conversation between us. But I want to kind of align some of the big picture stuff that I think we agree on. Of course, you can reframe it. But, you know, the core agreement, I think, is that gold and silver don't need to be investments to be indispensable. They need to function as money again. That's point number one. And now, Brainy, I'm going to give you a couple. The problem is that gold's volatility. It's the volatility of irredeemable credit. And the last one is sound money isn't about predictions, it's about incentives and discipline. So let me throw those three bullet points at you and let's start our conversation, if you will.
Absolutely. I think so the first one was they don't need to be investments, it's about being money. Absolutely agreed. The second one was it's not about predictions, but it's about
it's not about gold's volatility. It's the volatility of irredeemable credit.
With which we measure gold. Most people measure gold in terms of irredeemable credits, right? But the volatility, perceived volatility of gold is just the inverse of the volatility of the thing you're measuring it in. So I love the analogy of suppose you're standing on the deck of a ship and number one, the ship is slowly sinking. And number two, there's a big storm and it's going up and down 20-foot waves. And you're looking from the deck of that ship, which is slowly going down, is tossing all over the place. And you're looking at a lighthouse on the coast. And you're saying, why is the lighthouse going up and down and mostly up?
Exactly. Yeah. And the last one I threw at you, sound money isn't about prediction. It's about incentives and discipline.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a quote from Keynes that most people in the gold community would be aware, at least the first part of it, when he said, I love how he, sort of a sneaky, sketchy bastard, he said, Lenin is said to have said. And so now, I'm not saying this, is just Lenin, I'm just quoting. And there's no evidence that Lenin actually said this, but Keynes said it in one of his books, which is there's no surer way to overthrow the capitalist order, which means overthrow civilization, by the way. There's no surer way to overthrow civilization than by debauching the money. And Keynes is pretty, you know, smug. He's kind of smirking when he says this. And it's clear as you go through this that, yeah, he's thinking, yeah, this would be pretty cool, you know, to do this. Let's light it all on fire. It's like Batman talking to Alfred and saying, what motivates the Joker? And Alfred said, yeah, back in the war, you know, there were guys that they didn't want money. You couldn't bribe them. They didn't want women. They didn't want, you know, treasure. They just wanted to see the world burn. Anyway, so he goes on and on about impoverishing everybody, but arbitrarily enriching a few. And those who are enriched will be resented even by their fellow bourgeois, blah, 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 blah. And most people assume he's talking about inflation. Now, I suspect you remember, as I do, the late 1970s. I was 12 years old in 1979, you know, the stagflation era. And you know, Keynes said, not one in a million will recognize what's happening to their world. And if he was talking about inflation, he was an idiot, because everybody in 1979 was talking about inflation, as they are now, every day. So to think that, oh, no one would notice this, I don't think that's what Keynes meant. I think he was evil, but I think he was actually very smart. Yeah. I think he was smarter than most of his critics. So the last part of his quote, he says, we can destroy the world by engaging all of the hidden forces of economics in favor of destruction. Mm-hmm. And to your point, today the word for hidden forces of economics, we call that incentives. Incentives are much better understood today with public choice theory and other, you know, things becoming mainstream, you know, theories. And Keynes is saying, if you offer perverse incentives, you can destroy the world. And because people are pursuing incentives and they think they're getting rich, they don't object to it. They don't see there's a problem. And that's one of the biggest, deadliest things caused by irredeemable currency is just, as I saw a term on a Twitter post the other day, the gamblification of finance markets, where everything's turned into a gamble. Place your bets, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's stocks, whether it's silver for that matter, everything going up and down. And if you time it right, you can make huge amounts of dollars. And then you can trade your dollars for gold. And then, you know, now you've enriched yourself. But where did the riches come from? From somebody else's, you know, it's been a transfer of wealth from somebody else to you. And nobody really thinks about that. That's what Keynes was saying. This is how you can destroy the world. So, yes, I absolutely agree. In an honest monetary system, you don't get the volatility. And therefore, it's not that you make speculation illegal. It's that there's no profits to be had speculating. You got to earn money the old-fashioned way. You got to produce something a customer wants to buy, which is harder, but ultimately more rewarding.
Very good. That kind of leads me to the next one, a little bit of a, I guess a contrast between you and I. I'd say, how do you think about the trade-off between earning yield and preserving maximum liquidity in a true systemic event?
Well, everybody's got to plan for their liquidity needs. The more leveraged you are, the more liquidity you need. If you're not leveraged, you don't need any more liquidity in a financial crisis than you do any other time, unless you want to say you want to have dry powder. But how long do you want to sit on the sidelines when it isn't a crisis, holding your powder dry for that one moment? You know, so everyone's got to think about that. And you know, you're right. In monetary metals, to get that yield, there's a one-year lease contract. And so if that one-year lease happens to be when there's a crisis, now there's no, you know, the leasing that we're doing, this is for physical inventory and, you know, jewelry stores and mints and recyclers. It's not financialized. There's no leverage on it. It's not going anywhere. But if the rest of your portfolio is blowing up and you're levered up, you know, 5-to-1 on margin, and you're getting margin calls over the place, you may need to liquidate that gold. And if it's locked up in a lease, you could be in a bad way. So yeah, either don't have the leverage or plan for the liquidity you might need. But if you don't have the leverage, or at least you have excess assets compared to what you think you'll need in liquidity, isn't it better to get paid a yield than to pay for storage? And that's our proposition.
Yeah, thanks for being so forthright. I would, you know, say that, you know, there's a happy medium for my thinking, and that is, one, don't overlever. Two, you don't have to get a yield on all of it. You know, people get some strange ideas, in my opinion. You know, like some of these, let's say, tokenized metals propositions. And people put like all their metal in there because they're getting a yield on it. Well, again, you need the optionality. So I think there's a balance. I think you could do both. You know, hey, I've got, you know, X amount of gold. I want to get a yield on 50% of it with Keith's program. And by the way, I'm asked often, you know, do I trust you? Do I, you know, think it's, you know, thoroughly on the up and up? And I always say, yes, I do, you know, especially on the gold side. And I think 4% is quite a good yield relative to in gold terms. Coming back to not our debate, but discussion, I think you can have both. You can't have a cake and eat it too. You just, you got to use your head. Now, there's some people that probably want to put all in there because they can't resist getting that 4%. But to me, I would have both. I'd have the optionality of, you know, if I need the liquidity, I've got it. And also, I'm getting a yield and everything. I never am a big believer in the all or nothing proposition. I like to have what you might call side bets, or again, the overused word optionality. You want to add on to that, or you want to move on to something else?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think most finance, like professional finance guys, will say that, you know, a lot of people tend to have binary thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, either something's a good idea or it isn't, and if it is, then you should be all in, and if it isn't, then you should do none of it. And a professional finance guy was, okay, fine, put 5% into it. Now, what I can tell you is that a lot of customers, when they sign up and open an account with us, start out thinking, I'll put all my, you know, I'm going to send my stash. I'm going to dig up whatever's in the backyard, pull it out of my sock drawer, wherever, you know, the gold may be, and I'm going to send that in. And as they go through the thought process, I don't have any percentages off the top of my head, but a pretty good percentage of them say, you know what, on second thought, I'm going to leave my stash where it is now. And I'm going to sell something else in my portfolio and, you know, buy more gold. And so they increase their allocation to gold, which makes sense because if gold is a costing asset, you only want 2% of your portfolio in it. If gold is a yielding asset, maybe you want 4, but, they perceive that gold with a yield is a good replacement for something else in the portfolio, and the stash remains where it is, and they end up increasing the allocation. And that's, you know, I mean, most of our customers start out at kind of low to mid single digits of the portfolios in gold anyway. They're not all in to gold, period, let alone putting all of their gold that they do have into our program. Most of their portfolio isn't gold. And then over time, I think it about doubles as they, get excited about it because gold with a yield is cool.
Okay. Let's talk about backwardation for a moment. For my my talking points, backwardation isn't a pricing anomaly. It's a signal of scarcity preference. What say you?
That's what it is. It's a spread between the spot market and the futures market. And so people that are looking at price charts will never see it. You're not right. Looking in the right place. It's also a very sensitive indicator. The difference between spot and futures, people talk about decoupling of the paper market from the physical market. Even when it's backwardated, the amount of difference between the two is pretty small. Mm-hmm. You measure it as on an annualized basis percentage. Typically might be low single digits. Silver, we got a much bigger backwardation in October. It was $2.15 as we calculated it on October 10. That is, if you sold spot silver and bought on the bid and bought December silver at the offer price, you would pocket $2.15 and have the same amount of metal at the end of December.
Yeah.
That, I've never seen that before. That's massive.
It was massive. So but it didn't last long.
The degree of scarcity was high.
Let me probe a little bit deeper on this topic. So do you see silver's basis behavior today more industrial stress or early monetary stress?
Silver definitely has a dual nature. I mean, there's no denying that it's used in all kinds of industrial applications. And there's no denying that some silver every year is consumed, never coming back to market. Virtually all of the gold, when gold is manufactured, let's say into electronics, those electronics are generally recycled because, gold is thousands of dollars per ounce. It's worth it to recycle it.
Sure.
And even a $60 silver may not be, somebody throws out an old washing machine that may go into a landfill, even though there's a little bit of silver in the relay contacts. Some silver is being consumed. That's definitely industrial. That said, silver still has a very large amount of accumulated stocks. It still behaves as a monetary commodity, of which there are two. And I have a very interesting anecdote, which is, I'm not really an academic. If I were inclined and I had the time and the energy and academic inclination, I think I'd write this up as a paper and submit it to a peer-reviewed journal. So we do gold and silver generally, and gold leases we pay interest in gold, and silver leases we pay interest in silver, which makes sense. So we had a lessee who said, "Would you lease us some platinum?" One time, this was years ago now, and so we went to our customers. We didn't have any platinum on deposit. We didn't touch the stuff, and went to our customers and said, "Is anybody interested? Anybody have any platinum would be interested in leasing?" We got a lot of hands raised. I mean, it was oversubscribed like 5 times. Okay, great. Let's do it. So we went to all the participants in this lease and said, "Now, the gold leases pay interest in gold. The silver leases pay interest in silver. Here's a platinum lease. Do you want the interest in platinum in kind, the way we do the other leases, or do you want the interest in gold? Now, the investors don't know each other, except maybe by random chance, if somebody introduces brother to our program, then, you know, they could talk with each other. But for the most part, they couldn't talk with each other. They don't know each other. I will tell you that 100%, there was no dissent, 100% unanimous. Everybody agreed on what they wanted the interest to be paid in. And the interest they wanted was gold, thus proving that platinum isn't money. At that time, it was more expensive than gold per ounce.
Oh, interesting.
It's an expensive industrial ingredient. It's not money.
Right.
We never had any controversy over paying silver leases in silver, however.
Interesting.
So silver behaving as money, platinum not. And I think that one incident, if I would, you know, to say, we conducted an experiment in monetary science and using our own market as a laboratory, I think that one experiment proved platinum isn't money. And so I shared that with somebody I met at a conference who'd been heavily involved in one of the big platinum industry groups and had a lot of platinum experience in his resume. And I told him that, and he said, yeah, I agree with you, platinum's not money. And he cited all the reasons. It was discovered far too recently, and it's not malleable in the same way gold is hard to work with, much higher temperatures, you know, to melt it and whatever. It doesn't really work. But anyways, I think silver is still money. It still behaves as money. And now, it's funny, there's an Austrians in Finance email, private email list, where this controversy right now is raging. What's the definition of money? And most of the people are saying, well, it's whatever circulates as the generally accepted medium of exchange. No, that's paper. The dollar is the medium of exchange. It ain't money. It's irredeemable credit, as you rightly, you know, pointed out. So Menger said, money is the most marketable commodity, marketability meaning a measure of the bid offer spread. And so gold is the most marketable commodity, and it always has been, it still is. It still behaves as money today. I studied under a guy named Fekete, and his answer on silver was that silver is the most marketable commodity in small transactions. Mm-hmm. If you're a wage earner and you want to put $50 or $100, let's say every 2 weeks, you take your paycheck and you want to put 10% of that into silver, $100. If you do that in silver, you know, I was going to say until last week, you get a small handful of metal. You know, silver is twice the volume for the same weight, and obviously much, much cheaper. You'd get a handful of silver. If you wanted to do that in gold, you get a tiny little wafer floating around in a little plastic window in a Certa card. That's not very emotionally satisfying, and it's far more expensive to manufacture something that small with that precision. The bid offer spread is much wider in gold of that, you know, physical gold product of that size versus silver. So silver is more marketable in the small. And it still is today. So it's still behaving as money. And is it being demonetized? Is it being consumed down? Is there a deficit? You know, by the data that I see, like everybody else, apparently that's the case. But what nobody knows is just exactly how much the stocks were, and how much running down of the stocks there would have to be before you could really say it was demonetized. The stocks in these things are much, much, much bigger than most people think, which is why the Hunt brothers couldn't corner it, why Warren Buffett couldn't corner it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot more of it out there. And when the price goes up, more metal comes to market. It fixes the price.
Very good. I want to go back, and I'll have you reiterate something you said in our recent interview. In fact, I watched it this morning pretty early. And hopefully you don't muff this, but you talked about the fact that the refiners are in a bit of a squeeze maybe squeeze is the wrong word. Refiners have a bit of a hardship because they cannot really hedge if you're in backwardation, and that puts them in a quandary, my word, not yours. Could you go over that again and say it one more time, and then I want to, you know, dive down that trail a little bit further.
So first of all, I want to clarify, this is not happening now. On December 10th,
correct.
It was happening. It was happening in October, when this backwardation was extreme. So, you know, if you're a refiner, okay. So let me take a step back. You have a scarcity of the metal. you would think we talk about incentives, the producer of something has a great incentive to produce more and deliver it into the market if there's a shortage of something or something scarce. You know, normally in a free market, there's an incentive to produce and ship more, you know, product to alleviate the scarcity. But in backwardation means there's a scarcity in silver. And, you know, there's a lot of theories for that, one of which is that in India, it was Diwali, which is their big, you know, festival. And with the price of gold being what it is, a lot of Indians are substituting silver for gold because they can't really afford, certainly can't afford nearly as much gold as they used to. And for the same amount of money, you can get a much more satisfying chunk of silver versus a very unsatisfying tiny bit of gold for the same money. So, you know, they were importing silver. There's a lot of things going on, but you have a scarcity of silver. So you would think, okay, the refiners want to produce more, but they were turning away both silver, you know, dore, you know, coming out of the mines, and they were turning away scrap silver. So once the silver price, you know, really spiked up, more and more people were bringing in silver tea sets and platters and silverware and, you know, all this candelabras, all kinds of stuff that families have accumulated for who knows how many generations. You get to, you know, $40, especially $50, which, you know, we've never seen that before until now. And all the silver comes out and the refiners are saying no. Now, why would, and so very perverse, why were the refiners saying no? Because if they buy that silver, they've got to hedge it. And with the amount of scrap coming in, they would have had to, you know, hold that position for a couple of weeks. They were just piling up boxes and boxes and boxes of the scrap. And so the cost of that hedge was $2.15 an ounce, which is far greater than the refining margin. And so it made no sense to bring that silver. They'd rather slow production and shut it down than attempt to put any hedges on during that, the worst of the backwardation. So that was my little thing about what was going on with the refiners.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I just want to develop a subset of that that does exist. There are some metal-centric refiners. This is my key point. They're privately held, usually vertically integrated, and closely tied to the mining, bullion dealers, and sovereign buyers. And they don't really think so much in terms of fiat. They measure profits in ounces, not dollars. Care more about the metal throughput than recovery rates, and may already have forward metal offtake agreements. For those refiners, this is a subset, small. They do not hedge price the same way. Price volatility is less relevant to them, and backwardation is not a constraint. It can be an advantage. This is only for refiners that take metal as their reward, as their payment, rather than having to hedge in the traditional way of fiat. Again, it's a small part of the industry, but kind of first thing that popped in my mind when I listened to you this morning, that some people don't know that. I wrote an article about that years ago, Keith, and one of the less, how do I say this kindly, very remiss to give any credit to anyone else and very seldom gives an accolade, wrote that article and complimented me, which I took to heart because they don't give them often. But regardless, that's just part of it. I just want to get that out there. They're long metal by design, not by any other method. So you want to add on to that?
I love it. If there's Western companies that are essentially keeping their balance sheet in metal, I love it. Not at all uncommon in the East for, you know, the industry to keep their balance sheet essentially in metal. In Turkey, I'm told the entire gold industry, the entire gold sector, keeps their balance sheet in gold. So what's pioneering and daring and rare and unusual, and you have to write an article about it in the West, is just endemic in Turkey, and no one even talks. It's like no one talks about what a McDonald's is. There's no academic papers on a drive-through window for a fast food place because everyone's just doing it, right? It's just part of everyday life, and that's how it is in Turkey. I talk about paying for things in metal. I visited with it's an Indian-owned jewelry wholesaler in Dubai a couple of weeks ago, and I got a tour of their office, and they have this gigantic bolt cutter. And you know, I'm not in building maintenance and whatever. So maybe somebody who does that professionally can say, Keith, you're full of crap. That's just very ordinary. But anyway, it was pretty big. It felt like the thing weighed 20 kilos or something. I took a picture of myself. I should probably send it to you so you can post it to the to this you know, video podcast. You know, I took a picture holding this thing, and I said, you know, you must have some seriously high security padlocks you're cutting with this thing. They said, oh no, you know, we use it for cutting bars. I was like, what? And they said, oh yeah, well, you know, we cut kilo bars with it. So why in the world would you want to cut gold bar? Well, when we sell the jewelry to the retailers, they pay in kilo bars. This is how we make change. So I said, okay, yep. Well, you just made me wrong, because I've been writing about this for probably 10, 15 years, that, you know, the problem with bigger bars is they're inconvenient because of the granularity. I mean, you know, even though gold is soft and you could cut it with a pocket knife, you wouldn't want to, because you destroy the integrity of the bar. The bar no longer, it's marred, and the bar no longer has a kilo of weight in it, or whatever the weight is supposed to be. And the little slivers you cut off of it, what, who knows what those things are, and are they gold or not? And, you know, but what's problematic in the West is, you know, commonplace, that's how jewelers buy their jewelry. And, you know, if they buy 7.3 kilos of jewelry, then somebody cuts a bar and tries to cut off 0.3, you know, kilos of it. And now they do keep a debit or credit for whatever the, you know, they do weigh it. And if it's not perfectly accurate, you know, they'll note that in a ledger. But there is a part of the world in which metal is circulating as a medium of exchange and, you know, being used in all these ways. And yes, they're even cutting bars. Not very common in the U.S. If there's silver refiners doing that in the U.S., man, my hat's off to them. That's cool.
Yeah, well, most of the ones I know for a fact are not U.S.-based, just to be clear on that, Keith.
Okay.
So you kind of alluded to this already, talking about the above-ground silver supply, and no one really knows. Of course, we get the Silver Institute's work. We get the CPM Group's work. We look at Metals Focus and others, but, you know, it's a guess. It's a wag. But anyway, on point, this question is, do you think silver can ever support a true lease market at scale, or will industrial demand always distort it?
Silver support a true lease market
at scale. In other words,
yeah,
you know, the wake up call comes, and going from a 1% gold owned silver ownership in the United States goes to 10%, and 10% of them want to lease their silver through your company.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So
the same problem exists in gold and silver, which is the amount of metal that exists in human hands is much, much, much greater than, I mean, leasing is a niche market.
Right.
Now, if you're a startup, it's a pretty darn big niche. I mean, you can go all the way from start to, you know, if you're inclined to exit a business, I'm not, but you can go all the way from start to exit and have, you know, make a fantastic amount of money and retire on a yacht and, you know, a property in Lake Como and a property in, you know, central, you know, Midtown Manhattan or whatever on just that market. But it's a niche market. It's very small relative to the total amount of gold or silver out there. And so, you know, our plan is to introduce other products, not just leasing. So I guess the answer to your question is no, that wouldn't really work at scale, because there's only so much lease opportunity. When you look at, you know, gold, you have all the jewelry and stuff that you can lease gold to. And silver, you know, the problem is the jewelry store is still going to be the same number of kilograms. But, you know, if you have a store, let's say in the Middle East, with 50 kilos of gold in it, that's worth doing a lease. 50 kilos of gold is like, you know, what is that, $6 million or something. 50 kilos of silver isn't. It's not really a lease opportunity. So, you know, there are, you know, natural lessees of silver. Refiners are doing much larger amounts. Their petrochemical company, silver, is used in certain chemical reactors as a catalyst. the silver sponge in the bottom of a tank, and they're making ethylene or whatever they're making with it. And that can be millions of ounces, in a couple of tanks at a big plant. So there's definitely a market there. I mean, that market's definitely billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars anyway. But no, if everyone starts to wake up and say, yes, I want to get a return on my silver, we have to develop other markets, not just leasing.
All right, another tack at from an Austrian perspective, which we both agree on. Interest rates are supposed to ration capital, not paper over insolvency. What do you think?
Yes.
Want to say any more or move on?
I mean, there's a term from a very non-Austrian guy who I'm not a fan of, John Kenneth Galbraith. And he coined the term, I think this is in the 1950s or 1960s, the bezel, as in the root of embezzlement. And the bezel is the difference between the market valuation of something versus its true value. And the difference is essentially kind of a fraud or a counterfeiting, which I love because that's my definition of inflation is monetary counterfeiting. Nothing to do with the quantity of it, but it's the fraud of it. And the problem is every time the interest rate ticks down, which it had been doing from 1981 to 2021, 40 years, 2022, 41 years. And then we had this, I believe, abortive attempt at hiking rates, which I believe will resume the falling trend sooner or later, probably in 2026. Every time the interest rate ticks down, asset prices tick up. That's what Keynes was referring to with this quote about destroying the world that nobody can diagnose it because they love a bull market. And so the bezel is increasing every time it's not like things become worth more, but the net present value calculation that any finance guy would know, says if the interest rate is cut in half, the value of any perpetual asset doubles. And then you cut it in half again, you cut it in half again, and so on. So you're creating this enormous bezel, which papers over all sorts of insolvencies. And so, this gets to the root of one of the most fundamental questions of economics. How do you determine if an enterprise is creating or destroying capital or wealth? And so, the Austrians would say it's subjective. And I would say, oh, au contraire, I beg to differ, sir. You have to know if you're destroying or creating. And that is objective. That is black and white. That is not subjective. And if the interest rate is constantly falling, it completely distorts. You have no means of measuring it anymore. What is destroying wealth looks like it apparently is creating wealth. And, I haven't seen the statistic in a long time now, but pre-rate hikes, 20% of all the corporate debt out there was so-called zombie,
It
and zombie
was.
debt. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, no, I read the same thing, 20%.
That was before the rate hikes.
Yes.
So once you hike rates, all you're doing is you're just raising the threshold. More and more are now underneath that threshold. At 5% federal funds rate, I don't know what percentage of debt was zombie, but it was a hell of a lot higher than 20%. And all of that zombie debt should be liquidated at some point. And if you force the interest rate down rather than up, you prevent that liquidation. You're not doing anybody any good in the long run.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and get this wrapped up. This is kind of my killer close question for you, Keith. And I think everybody wants to know this, at least your opinion on it. What breaks first in this stress system? Price, liquidity, trust.
Wow. What breaks first? I think they're all highly connected. When I clap my hands, which hand makes the clap noise first? That's maybe my answer to that. So as trust erodes, which is, my backwardation thesis is that the metals only, gold and silver only go into backwardation when there's an erosion of trust. As the trust erodes, the price goes up, and you know, things become more illiquid. And, you know, I've seen economists whom I respect and like talk about, you know, this idea that in any normal market, it's the bid that's withdrawn, but they say that in gold, it's the offer that's withdrawn. And that's where I have to say, no. You're standing on the deck of the ship saying, why is the lighthouse going up? It's, you know, it is true for gold and everything else. It's always the bid that's withdrawn in a crisis because of the trust is being withdrawn. It's just that you think the dollar is money, and so you're trying to look at gold from a dollar-centric bubble, and you're missing the point. It's like before Copernicus, they were looking at the other planets, assuming they revolve around the Earth, and then it was very complicated for them to describe the motions. When you realize that the Earth and the other planets are going around the Sun, it gets a hell of a lot simpler. When you realize that it's gold bidding on the dollar and not the dollar bidding on gold, then it's much, much simpler. So I would say all three are aspects of the same, you know, crisis. And the crisis is, intermittently sputtering and has been since 2008. And I think this can has a few more good kicks left in. I mean, I don't think it's like imminent in the dollar. Peripheral currencies, maybe. You could see some peripheral currencies falling over soon, but not the dollar, not yet.
Very good. Well, you know, I could talk to you for hours. Just as an aside, I used to do a workshop at almost every Silver Summit when we used to have them here in Spokane or Coeur d'Alene. And years ago, probably a decade or so, I had a whiteboard way back, and I just wrote the word trust. And basically, and they all tied together. I agree with your answer. And I just said, you know, when the trust goes, and that's kind of the first big domino to fall and start hitting that 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16, you get an exponential, or can get an exponential effect. And that's when you get, of course, a parabolic move in, usually the heart, you know, the money metals. But I can go on and on. I love our discussions. It's always very thought-provoking, hopefully for the audience as well. Wrapping up here, why don't we just talk, I'll give you the floor again to just describe what you do at Monetary Metals. I know Rafa Farber is a fan. I've introduced a lot of people to the program. A lot of people are kind of, you know, when they hear it for the first time, oh my goodness, you know, I've been taught forever, you can't get a yield on gold, or you can't get a yield on silver. Now you can. So just go through that briefly for the audience, so that when we publish this, more and more people wake up to the fact that they can put some or all, if they choose, of their metals to work.
You know, if gold is money and silver, which is the thesis, then it should be possible to put it to work and get a yield. So that's what we do. We pay yield. We have two programs. We have leasing, we have lending. They have different risks and different interest rates. Lending is for accredited investors only. But I'd like to talk about the why. I mean, okay, 4% on your gold, is that better than paying 75 basis points for storage? Everyone can make their own, you know, determination of that. But I'd like to talk about the why, because that's what makes this matter. What we're trying to do is bring gold back into use, back into circulation. And what began as an economic thesis for me has become, you know, the thesis for the business and the business model. If you offer interest, gold will come to market. If there is no interest available, then all the gold will disappear into private hoards, which is exactly how the world had been before, you know, we started the company, and had been that way for many, many decades, obviously. So we want to bring it back into circulation so we can use gold rather than government's irredeemable broken promises as money. And we got to get it to circulate. The way to get it to circulate is to pay interest on it. And that's what this is all about. So I hope everybody, if they're not, you know, whether or not they're ready to do it, you know, not just come to our website for the sake of clicks, but follow our journey, watch our press releases, see what we're doing. Because we're bringing it back, and we're doing that by putting it to work, financing productive enterprise. That's the key. It's not some self-referential, you know, scheme where the market generates endogenous returns somehow internal to the market itself. It's no, we're putting it to work in jewelry stores and mints and refiners and recyclers. There's a lot of businesses that have physical metals inventory, and that has to be financed, and we do it on lease. not too different from you walk into a car dealership, they got 300 cars on the back lot. Those are not owned by the dealer, those are on lease, you know, finance. We're doing that with gold. The difference is cars get stale after a year and there's a new model year. Gold doesn't get stale. Gold doesn't weather, you know, in the rain and the sun. And, you know, gold is eternal. So leasing makes more sense for gold than it does for cars.
Well, very good. Keith, I appreciate the clarity you bring to this discussion. What stands out to me is that sound money isn't about prediction or price targets. It's about restoring discipline, settlement, and trust. Whether people think in yield or in ounces, the common thread is the same. Money should work, not distort behavior. These conversations matter because monetary systems don't fail loudly at first. They fail quietly and then an all out at one time. Thanks for helping us think through a deeper level, which always happens when you and I have a discussion. Thanks again, Keith.
Thank you.